Charlotte Talks just marked its 22nd year on the air on WFAE. When the show launched, Charlotte was wrestling with growth, the role of race in public schools, transportation. There were big bank mergers, and the country was headed toward a presidential impeachment. The more things change, huh? What hasn't changed is the importance of listeners' financial support. Click the donate button at WFAE.org or call 704-549-9000. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the number of COVID-19 cases in North Carolina tops 10,000, and the mounting total breaks another single-day record. Mecklenburg ends its stay-at-home order, defaulting to the state's restrictions, even as Gaston County muddies the water with sound and fury over the governor's order, which ends up signifying nothing. City Council narrowly votes to approve a $50 million grant for the Republican convention. Schools scramble to figure out how to operate in this new environment. And remember those panic alarms at CMS that allegedly didn't work? Well, a lawsuit is now in the offing. Our roundtable of reporters is ready, and they include two WFAE reporters, Steve Harrison and David Borax. Good morning, Steve.
Morning.
Morning, David.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
I'm good. Annie Ma reports on education for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome to you.
Good morning.
And Eric Spanberg is here. He's managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Welcome back.
Hello, Mike.
Hello. So, U.S. has 1 million cases, over a million cases. North Carolina is reporting, as of this morning, 10,703 cases, 397 deaths, 561 cases. New cases were reported from Wednesday to Thursday, which broke another single-day record. And yet, the state is still on track to end stay-at-home orders in 7 days, next week, May 8th. And although Mecklenburg still has the highest number of coronavirus cases, County Manager Dina DiOrio announced the county had rescinded its stay-at-home orders, which were more restrictive than the state's, allowing the state's orders to be the guiding policy.
We think that the data that we have in place today, in terms of where we are in cases and hospital capacity, that we think it's time for us to be able to lift those restrictions and move and align with the governor's order.
I have to ask the obvious question. Is that wise? And Steve, before we started, you were saying that maybe we're not ready?
Well, I mean, I think what's interesting is that the state has laid out these metrics to see if we're going to reopen. And, you know, right now, three of the four are arguably not looking great. Now, I don't think that necessarily means you can't open, but it's kind of the goals they've set for themselves aren't looking great. So I think it's going to be interesting to see come next week, early next week, which is when they'll have to decide whether they can, you know, kind of say we're ready. And I think it's interesting with Mecklenburg County, we go back a week ago and the messaging from the health director in the county was still kind of dire. It was, we need more stay at home, spike in cases, et cetera. And really nothing has changed over the past week. Cases are still kind of adding at the same level. Hospitalizations are about the same. You give it a week. And then when it appears the governor is kind of giving everyone the okay, then it's suddenly like, we think we're good. We think we can do this. So it's just interesting to watch the messaging on this change.
Well, and again, remember, Steve, I go back to that county meeting a couple of weeks ago, and there was that exchange between the county manager and the county attorney about who had supremacy when it comes to stay at home. And then they came back a week later, and Dina DiOrio originally thought, hey, whatever Mecklenburg wants to do, that will be what happens going forward for all the towns. And as soon as they found out that wasn't going to work, the tenor and the tone of this really shifted quickly. And I think that's what you were hearing this week.
You know, the county and the state have put us on a track towards this opening, and it's going to take some real political leadership here if they decide that we are not on that track. And there's a lot of pushback, as we know right now, with the Reopen NC movement, and there's been a lot of attention to that. So they're going to have to kind of send some new messaging if they think we're not on track for that.
Well, I do think that politics is part of this, obviously. And that the Cooper administration, I think it's safe to say, did not want to reopen last week and be lumped in with South Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee. I don't think that's a good look. So it was kind of pushed down the road to May 8th. And like David said, so you know, you've taken this kind of middle ground, this prudent course, and how, if the numbers aren't there, what do you do? How do you prepare people for that? Because I think there's an appetite to get this moving, not just within the reopen NC movement.
Yeah. And I think when you, like Cooper kind of tried to go down the middle, but with pushing things down the line, but when you put a date like May 8th out there, people kind of anchor that in their minds. And it's going to be hard to push that date down the line even further, because it's kind of what people are operating with as an expectation to at least move into phase one.
So next week we're going to go into phase one if everything turns out the way they're planning. And right now they've switched to the state's stay-at-home order, which was slightly more, it was looser than the Mecklenburg County order. So what can we do now that we couldn't do before they lifted the Mecklenburg County order?
Well, you have, I mean, basic things like you can park at parks now. There is more that you can do at parks. You can play, they've talked about playing tennis, I feel like, for endless amounts of time. So you can play tennis now. There are more shops, furniture stores, mattress stores, vape shops. You know, it's kind of a weird hodgepodge of things that were allowed by the state that you could not do in Mecklenburg County. Well, so,
and one of the things is that lawn and garden stores are now open, but they were always open. You could go to Lowe's and Home Depot and buy a lawnmower if you wanted to. What's the difference?
I had the same thought. I don't have an answer on that. The other one that really kind of caught my attention was defense and military contractors. I would have thought that would have been something obvious that would have kept going, but who knows?
So all these restrictions have been slightly loosened beginning yesterday. The county evidently didn't make these decisions unilaterally. Their orders can only exist with the acquiescence of the six towns that ring Charlotte. Did these towns push the county to loosen these restrictions and go with the state's restrictions at this point in time? Are all these towns on the same page with this change?
Well, I think the one that really stood out was Matthews, the mayor. John Higdon wrote a letter to Dina DiOrio saying that while the policy that Mecklenburg County had in place had worked, it was now time to switch to the state orders that we're talking about. And that seemed to be the big one that pushed this in this direction. And I have a feeling you're probably going to have some clips maybe in that regard. So I'll stop talking, Mike.
You're prescient. You're prescient. Because Matthews and Huntersville were both against continuing the county's more restrictive stay-at-home orders, and they said they would no longer support them, to which County Commissioner Trevor Fuller made it known this week that he is not a fan of municipalities having what he called veto power over the entire county.
I think people who have been pushing this effort to undermine our actions to respond to this COVID-19, they ought to be ashamed of themselves, who are pushing to reopen in this reckless and political way. They should be ashamed of themselves.
I want to point out that Trevor Fuller is an at-large member of the county commission, which means he represents those towns in addition to the entire county. Steve, does that give his words greater weight or put him in greater jeopardy with constituents?
Well, I mean, he's going to go off the commission because he ran for Senate and lost. But what I think is interesting is, I mean, those were some pretty strong words, like reckless. But again, you know, then a few days later, the health director says, we think we're good to move into phase one. So, you know, I don't see how what Huntersville and Matthews were saying, which was this kind of, we need to move along with the slow reopening. Commissioner Fuller says it's reckless. And then the health director 2 days or a few days later says, you know, I think we can do this. I think we're on the right track. So it's just interesting to me how quickly things change in terms of, is the situation dire or is the situation okay?
Well, I think one thing, a couple of things that have come up. One, Trevor Fuller has talked a lot and pretty consistently the past few weeks about the precedent this sets in terms of the towns being able to really shift where Mecklenburg County wants to go. And the second point that he makes again and again is that Mecklenburg County is in charge of public health. That's what they do. They have the expertise. But remember, as I think everyone on this show does remember, unlike most counties, there's not a public health board. You just have a public health director. And I think that seems to be causing some tension among commissioners in terms of this decision.
Well, the and county the county commission serves as the public health board. Matthews Mayor John Higdon responded that Trevor Fuller's comments are a mischaracterization of his stance on this.
My intent is absolutely not to liberate North Carolina or open all businesses and open all of our restaurants and et cetera. Not at all. We want to follow Governor Cooper's order, which is still very restrictive. It's going to be phased over many, many weeks, months actually, before things can open again. But this would give some of our smaller retailers the opportunity to open and start earning some money and pay some of their bills.
So the state, because we are a Dillon rule state, the state can override the counties and the cities. Why can municipalities override the counties, Steve?
Well, I mean, and I think that was a question that, you know, that before we started this, that people didn't really know, right? Like Eric said, there was this debate in the county over whether they could do it or whether they couldn't. And then, you know, the county attorney decided that they did have veto power. So, I mean, I can't think of a situation ever before in my time here where this is a situation like this has come up. And, you know, it's possible that maybe they couldn't. I mean, maybe if this were, you know, kind of gone to court and drawn out, that ultimately would side with the county, that they could have forced Huntersville and Matthews to go along. I don't know. It's just, I've never seen this before.
Go ahead, Mike.
I'm sorry.
We're just making all this up as we go along because we've never experienced anything like this before. And I think everybody's feeling their way through it. But a shocking thing came to light, at least when I read it, it was shocking to me, that more Americans have now died in less than 2 months than in the entire 9 years of the Vietnam War. 58,000 people, and yet we keep hearing that we are flattening the curve, and we are flattening the curve, but all that means, if I understand this correctly, is that we are helping the hospital system to be able to work and not overexceed its capacity. It doesn't mean that we are lessening the number of people who are getting these infections. It doesn't mean that we are lessening the chance that they will die of these infections. And Harvard University says we need to start testing 5 million people a day in order to really get a handle on this. Are we moving in this county or anywhere else in that direction?
I mean, the state, yes, we're moving in that direction. But I mean, the idea of 5 million tests a day is so out there. I mean, I'm not saying it's a bad idea, but just in terms of where we are, I think the U.S. has tested about 6 million citizens in the whole span of this outbreak. So the idea of getting to 5 million a day is pretty mind-boggling. In North Carolina, the goal is to do 5 to 7,000 a day. They're starting to hit that, which is a good sign. And then, you know, just kind of saying one more thing that you mentioned about the flattening the curve. I think what everyone is seeing is that the back end of the curve looks a lot different than the front end, and that it just goes down so slowly on the back end that, you know, the cases don't fall as fast as they increased.
Well, and remember, so I think the state count, somewhere around 130,000 tests have been done during the 6-7 weeks that this has been going on. We're a state of 10.5 million people. And along those same lines, Gibby Harris said this week that there are roughly 600 to 700 tests a day being done, again, in a county of 1 million people. So that shows you there's a long way to go, even though they are starting to make some progress.
And it's hard to get any sense of if we're flattening the curve and how we're progressing if we don't have testing, right? Like, one thing that we've heard from the CDC and from public health officials is that so many people who have COVID-19 are asymptomatic. So you can't really get a grasp on what's happening if you don't have testing. And there's also been a lot of reporting that, like, in addition to the deaths from COVID that we've tracked, there's also people who've died who had COVID and we didn't know it until afterwards.
Andy Moss with the Charlotte Observer. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're joined by Steve Harrison from WFAE News, David Borax, also with WFAE, Annie Ma, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. The Observer is reporting today that nearly half, 24 out of 49 of the people who have died in Mecklenburg County from COVID-19 are connected to long-term care facilities. That's a tragic number. And you and your colleague, Fred Clayson Kelly, Annie, wrote an article this week reporting on a nurse sending an urgent plea to Mecklenburg County officials prior to the very first confirmed case here. What was that nurse asking?
Well, so the nurse and a lot of other people in Mecklenburg County were writing to government leaders, whether it's the city, the towns, the county, saying, we need to be proactive. Like, the way pandemics work is by the time you have your first case confirmed, it's already too late because that person has been bopping around the county infecting other people. And it was really urging county leaders to shut things down, to put in a shelter in place order to kind of limit movement in the county and get ahead of the coronavirus. But we know that the county didn't really act on that those pleas for weeks after they got them.
And you asked the question in that article, if the county waited too long to act, did they?
They would say that they don't want to speculate on that while people are still dying from coronavirus. But a lot of public health experts that we talk to locally and nationally say, like, it's like we have the benefit of hindsight, but it's obvious that had things been put in place sooner, you know, places that did put restrictions in sooner have seen a lighter caseload than we have in Mecklenburg County.
People are getting restless. Politicians are getting restless. Individuals are upset by this, particularly people who don't have an income because of the business closures. And reopen protests took place again this week in Raleigh. Nothing like what happened yesterday in Michigan, where people brought AK-47s into their state house, which is shocking. Davidson College student has started a Reopen Mech Facebook group to protest the county's stay-at-home order. This was before the county rescinded theirs and folded their restrictions into the state's. But Maya Pillay's Facebook group has planned to protest in Uptown Charlotte today at noon. How's that going to work? They're just going to go?
I think the plan is to do a mostly vehicle-based protests where they'll be driving down the street. I think we'll probably see some people out with signs. They're promising social distancing, but the idea is kind of a show of support for further reopening as soon as possible at the main intersection in downtown Charlotte, which I should point out, having been there a couple of times recently, it's as dead as it has ever been since I've lived in Charlotte, since maybe the early 90s.
Yeah, looks like 1985. Agree or disagree with Mecklenburg County's move this week to follow the state's less restrictive ordinances? At least they have been, in Mecklenburg County, very clear about expectations and outcomes. Over in Gaston County, things got a little murky when Tracy Philbeck, the chair of the Gaston County Commission, announced a proclamation that many saw as defying the governor's order.
If you own a business in Gaston County, and you can practice social distancing, strict sanitation, and proper hygiene, your Gaston County Commission supports your decision and your right to go back to work.
So that sounded to everybody at first that they were reopening despite the state's order, but that was not the case. Why the confusion?
I think what's interesting about that event on Wednesday, that it wasn't just Tracy Philbeck, the chair of the commission. This was a news conference with the county manager, Kim Eagle, who was at one point going really close to being the city manager of Charlotte. The county attorney was there, the county spokesperson. It was kind of basically all of Gaston's leadership making this pledge and this announcement that, and then, you know, later Gaston County officials said, you know, hey, we are open for business. All businesses can open. And then throughout the day, you know, there was started to be pushback from the governor's office and even the individual municipalities, and it became really unclear exactly what they were saying.
Yeah, the governor's office said that this announcement was dangerous, and State Health Director Mandy Cohen reacted this way.
we're in a crisis, and I think confusion is really, really damaging during a crisis.
And the governor's response also pointed out that the state's requirements supersede the county's, and the county then what, backtracked with a statement that said that they would, quote, continue to follow all state laws, including Governor Cooper's executive order. But then Commissioner Philbeck said, in spite of the governor's order, we support and will stand with those that want to open their businesses and go to work. What is this? What are we to make of this? Is this just politics? He's a Republican, and he's following in the footsteps of Donald Trump, wanting everybody to go back to work. Is that what this is? I support going back
politics.
To work.
There's no question that it's politics here. Philbeck has even gone so far. Yesterday, I talked to him on the phone, and he said that he and the county are ready to go to court to try and overturn the governor's order. It's not clear if that's going to happen anytime soon. He said it might be individuals who do it. It might be county, it might be both. But he feels strongly about this. It does seem to me that there's more going on here behind the scenes. I also should note that some of the county commissioners there said they did not expect what was announced Wednesday morning. They thought they were getting ready to vote on a resolution that would, acknowledge that the state order now goes through May 8th. So not everybody was on board.
And like I said, the strange thing about it was, if this was Tracy Philbeck who made the announcement, like outside his house or by himself outside the Gaston Government Center, I think everyone would have paid attention, but it would have been like really small news, right? Mm. The fact that you had all of the top Gaston officials there lined up behind this gave it this, weight and this importance. And I mean, it'll be fascinating to see whether those officials, like the county manager, kind of realized how this was going to play out, if they knew what they were getting into, because it's just crazy to think that they would put themselves out there against the governor that boldly.
Well, and to that point, Steve, it was interesting because later in the day, I believe Kim Eagle, who's the county manager that you're referring to, didn't she put out a written statement that said we would never ask our employees to break the law or something to that effect? So that does make you wonder if everybody was on the same page at the beginning compared to how it wound up at the end of the day.
And it didn't take long for the cities and towns in Gaston County to push back on this. The mayors of 12 municipalities issued a statement saying that businesses and residents were required to comply with the state orders. The Observer wrote an editorial characterizing all this as comical, cowardly defiance. They said, quote, Gaston Commissioner Tracy Philbeck got the big headlines he surely was going for when he told reporters Wednesday morning that his county would be open for business in defiance of the governor's stay-at-home order. But within hours, the commissioner's bold declaration was exposed for what it actually was, an ill-conceived, comically executed, and ultimately spineless political stunt. Is that what it was, or did Philbeck intend to go through with this if no one had reacted?
I mean, I think it's hard to say, but you can, in the editorial, Peter, our writer, talked to the county spokesman, I believe, who also seems exasperated and confused and is like, yes, they are going, that's basically what they're saying, but also acknowledges it's a mess. So it's clear, I think you're right, Mike, there was not a unified, we're all on the same page. It seemed a little bit like they jumped in and then some people were like, how did I end up here?
So if he just waited a week, he could have followed in the footsteps of this announcement from Mecklenburg County Health Director Gibby Harris.
I feel confident, unless there is some drastic change in the next couple of days, which we don't anticipate, that we'll be ready to move into phase one next week.
But she cautioned it will be up to everyone together and individually to adhere to social distancing guidelines. So on May 9th, I guess the current situation ends what, May 7th or 8th?
8th.
8th. Yeah.
So on May 9th, are we all to run free through the streets? What are we allowed to do on May 9th?
Well, no, I think that's going to be a big part of this. We've talked so much about communication and messaging, and that's so important in a public health emergency. I think a lot of people have, as Annie put it, anchored that May 8th date in their minds, and they think, hey, everything's opening up. It's not that way. It loosens some things, it allows you to do more things, but you're still encouraged to telecommute, for example. So, and restaurants and bars, you're not going to be able to sit down in those places for another 4 to 6 weeks, assuming everything goes well. So there are a lot of nuances to this. And I think that's going to be a big part of this next week, is whether the governor and mayors and county managers and everyone else can convey that, so that you don't just sort of have everybody flooding into the street thinking they can do everything on May 9th.
And I think with May 8th, like phase one, I mean, if I may be mistaken, but I think stay at home is still in effect.
Yes.
I mean, it just loosens it up. So in theory, I think, and that you are still, you know, that the cap on gatherings is still at 10, and you are not supposed to go socialize with other people. You are allowed as a family or yourself to go visit more businesses and do more things. But right. Yeah, I think people are going to be like, wait a minute, this doesn't really change much at all.
I mean, we will see more people in parks. I think there'll be some new stores open that aren't open right now that don't qualify as essential in the same way. Sporting goods stores, you'll be able to buy those golf clubs you want. Clothing stores will be open again. Bookstores, I think, will be open. And so the number of stores will be expanded, but that doesn't do away with any of the social distancing requirements. And we're all still going to be encouraged to wear masks and that sort of thing. So.
Yeah, and the governor expressed optimism about being able to go through with this next week, but he also had words of caution.
Stay vigilant. Right now, we need people to continue following the stay-at-home order so that we can move into the phases of easing restrictions. Complacency could risk lives and undo these plans.
Gibby Harris, Mecklenburg County's health director, will be joining us on this program next Thursday. That's the eve of the state potentially going into the first phase of the reopening, and we'll get a complete explanation from her about what will go forward from there and why they feel now is the time is right to do this. And before we move on, I made casual mention of the fact that the protesters in Michigan yesterday were carrying automatic weapons with them into not only the statehouse lobby, but into the gallery of these statehouse representatives in the state of Michigan, where the governor, whose stay-at-home order is overwhelmingly supported by the population there, it was just shocking to see people with automatic weapons in a statehouse. But this morning, outside Raleigh's Oakwood Cemetery, there were people protesting the stay-at-home orders armed with rifles. What's going on here?
I think everyone's speechless. I mean, I can't even conceive of a capital that would allow firearms. I am assuming that they don't in Raleigh. I've never seen them. It's kind of head spinning to see what a small percentage of people are willing to do to try and get stay at home restrictions lifted. I guess that's the most optimistic way to put it. I don't even know how to describe it.
So you know, this does continue a trend that's been happening for the past few years, which is that I think things that people considered not appropriate for polite company are on the table now as things that, you know, some people are willing to do in public. And
well, I think the country has lost its way, and I don't know that we're going to find our way back onto the track, because that's just insanity. What was going on in Michigan yesterday? Okay. Meanwhile, some good news. Let's talk about some good news. Promising news out of UNC Chapel Hill this week about a treatment that reduces recovery time for patients with COVID-19. And they've had some pretty positive results there. And I think in Boston, where they're also working on the same drug, remdesivir, which originated, I believe, in labs here, these tests. UNC epidemiologist Ralph Barrick was on this program a couple of weeks ago. One of the world's leading experts in this area says this is a game changer for COVID-19 patients. What does this drug do? How quickly does it work? How can people get it if they have this disease?
So I think the idea behind remdesivir is that it's a antiviral drug that was, I think, used back in 2014 on Ebola patients. And the hope is that, and I think it was also used in some cases on SARS, the hope is that it blocks the virus from replicating as fast as it does. And they have done a trial on about 1,000 patients. Some were given the drug, some were given the placebo. And yeah, it's been the most promising treatment so far. Anthony Fauci had high praise for it. So I think it allowed people to get out of the hospital faster. And so, yeah, good news.
And UNC epidemiologist Ralph Barrick, who runs that department at UNC Chapel Hill that's helping to test this drug, will also join us next Thursday on this program. So we'll get more information about that from him directly. But there's also some phase two trials, David, going on at both Atrium and Novant. Talk about those.
That's right, Mike. And, you know, we should note that there's lots of studies going on all around the world right now to try and combat this disease that has taken over. At Novant and Atrium over the past few weeks, they've both started phase two trials of some drugs that look promising. At Novant, they have something called leronlimab, which has previously been used for HIV and breast cancer. At Atrium, they're participating in an international trial for something called selinexor, which is used for bone marrow cancer. There's hope that these drugs also could be used in the treatment, and those studies are happening right here.
So we have tensions flaring all over the country, and tensions flared in city council chambers this week about the impending presence of the Republican National Convention. On a 6-5 vote, city council narrowly approved accepting a $50 million grant from the federal government for the convention, and Councilman Braxton Winston voted no.
We need to stop this charade right now. We should not tell our city staff, our CMPD, to use our resources to plan for something that we know that it is not going to happen.
Donald Trump says it absolutely is going to happen, but if the convention did not come here, would the city have to give back the $50 million it's now accepting? Do we know?
I think they would have to give it back, but the bigger point is that I think that if there is a convention here at all, in any shape or form, there will need to be some form of security. And if the city had turned down that money, then Charlotte taxpayers would have had to pay for it.
Yeah, so, Mayor Pro Tem Julie Eisel, who voted yes, argued that the city had a responsibility to accept that grant.
Essentially, we could be forced to have this convention if nothing else changed, the dates didn't change or whatever, and we'd be on the hook to pay for it.
So why the opposition, Steve? Why it's a grant.
It is a grant. And I think what's interesting, so this was a 6-5 vote, just like the 2018 vote to host was 6-5. You know, if you're on one of the five people voting no, and you know there's six votes lined up to pass this, it makes it very easy for you to cast a no vote and kind of stick it to the Republicans. If it was really up in the air as to whether this was going to pass or not, I think people would have had a very different position.
We'll talk some more about that and about the hoops that people in the world of education are jumping through to try to figure out what happens now in the world of COVID when we come back.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here on the local news roundup with Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, Steve Harrison from WFAE News, David Borax from WFA News, and Annie Ma from the Charlotte Observer. This $50 million grant that we were just talking about that the city council voted yes on to accept from the federal government defrays the costs of the additional security needed for the Republican National Convention. A similar grant came our way, if I'm not mistaken, for the Democratic National Convention. And they're thinking that this convention is supposed to bring 50,000 people into our midst. Malcolm Graham, a member of a city council from District 2, I believe, no longer believes that that many people will come. I know that some media outlets have decided not to come. If the number is substantially lower than 50,000 people, are we going to lose money on this convention in the city of Charlotte?
Well, I mean, you're going to lose. It depends how you mean that. You know, the local organizing committee is going to pay for the staging and the things that happen that turn the convention into the convention. But remember, the reason that the city pursued this is for the $120 million estimated impact in terms of spending from visitors and media and organizers. Obviously, that's going to go way down, and or it looks like it's going to go way down. And one of the things I thought was interesting, Mike, in that debate You heard Braxton Winston, not surprising. He's been pretty adamant that he doesn't think this is a good idea. And then he added the pandemic piece to it. But Ed Driggs, who is a Republican and is very much in favor of the convention, obviously, he made a comment before the vote that he said, quote, "I think it's pretty obvious that there's a good chance the convention is going to have to be modified and maybe even canceled." I thought that was a really interesting comment, given that you're hearing full steam ahead from the convention organizers. And here's a Republican who's saying, look, there's no way it's going to be what you thought it would be.
And another no vote came from Matt Newton, who said that he feared Charlotte would become a petri dish for the coronavirus if the convention came to town. If COVID-19 is still influencing how we conduct ourselves in the middle of August, if social distancing is still in place, if restaurants can only operate at 25 or 50% capacity, if the county or the state have rules in place limiting how large a gathering can be, can this convention be held?
It can be held in a very different fashion. I mean, remember, you also had Dr. Fauci tell WCNC last week that he was cautiously optimistic, but all the things that you're saying, Mike, seem very likely at the moment. In fact, Marsha Lee Kelly, who's the CEO of the Republican National Convention, said that, you know, they're already resigned to the fact that the TV shot will be of delegates wearing face masks. So they already know they're going to have a very different looking convention.
And they've said, too, you know, I think it was maybe it was the VP of the convention said, you know, we may have to social distance 6 feet apart. So all of a sudden, not only are you wearing masks, but you think about the floor of the Spectrum Center, instead of, what, 4,000 people, there would be 500. I mean, it would just be so bizarre.
You know, the David. City's contract with the convention allows for the full thing to happen. And so the next question is, what would cause that to change? And, you know, right now, in recent days, we've seen the president kind of chomping at the bit to get out. He's talking about the trips he's going to be taking around the country to do various visits and rallies and things. He's going to speak at the graduation, which is still going to be held at the U.S. Military Academy. He's eager to be back out there in front of his crowds. And I think that's going to drive a lot of this.
But so what's behind interesting this is, remember that the state has the final say on this in terms of what goes forward, what the rules, the guidelines are. The president is not in charge of what happens in Charlotte and North Carolina. So you could be setting up for a big political debate here.
What have we heard out of Milwaukee, which will be the site for the Democratic convention, at least the planned site? I know the Democrats have been more open about the possibility of doing a virtual convention than the Republicans have been, but what are we hearing from Milwaukee? Nothing?
I don't know.
Okay, we don't cover Milwaukee. It's okay. So let's talk about schools, because the schools are really up in the air. Online education is going. The governor's closed all the classrooms until the end of the school year, and now we're grappling with what to do about graduations. 101,000 high school seniors around the state are scheduled to graduate. They would love to have a ceremony. You can't do it indoors because of social distancing. Some have suggested, including the chair of the Union County School Board, that we put them in football stadiums where you can spread people out and you can sit in the fresh air and the sunshine, which has nothing to do with COVID-19 or preventing it, but you can spread people out. Are they considering alternatives to graduation ceremonies, Annie?
Yeah, so CMS hasn't committed to anything yet. They said graduation ceremonies aren't canceled, but they put together a task force to look for alternatives. They're asking for input from the community, so it could be anything. I've seen on Facebook the football suggestion, the like a drive-through graduation at the Speedway. Lots of things are being thrown out there, and they're going to put their final recommendations to the board, I believe, next week.
This is CMS?
Yes, this is just CMS, and I'm sure that counties across the state are having similar conversations. Like, how do you don't like senior year has so many important milestones that they've had to miss. Like, how do you give them that feeling of this is a capstone and an important part of your life without, you know, endangering people?
So these decisions about graduation will be made at the local level, not at the state level. One presumes.
I believe so about graduation ceremonies. The state handles more about like grading and stuff like that.
So the state is also trying to figure out what school will look like in the fall when the academic year might begin and when the academic year might begin. State Superintendent Mark Johnson launched a task force yesterday, I think it was, to figure out how schools will open in the fall. What are they charged with doing?
they're trying to figure out how you can safely social distance, whether that means bringing back all kids, some kids, doing some things virtually. There's also conversation about having like a jumpstart program before the actual start of school to get kids who were unable to access remote learning as robustly back on track through like getting caught, like teaching the last part of this year at the beginning of next year and making sure everybody starts on the same page.
Like everything in our world today, this task force is controversial because people are complaining about the makeup. The North Carolina Association of Educators agrees with the goals, but they don't agree with who's on the panel because they say there's nobody on the front lines, no cafeteria workers, no janitors, no teachers, no teacher assistants, nobody in the room with the kids on this task force. Has that criticism been responded to?
I don't know about a response. Well, DPI did say that like the list they put out is just a start and that they're going to add teachers and parents and students. But I think there's this bigger conversation in North Carolina about like when you talk about educators, what does that mean, right? And NCAE would say it includes all your support staff. It includes the bus drivers. It includes everyone that helps the school run because you can't educate children if the whole system doesn't work. And they definitely feel like those people are stakeholders and should have a voice at the table representing them.
And both the House and Senate chambers have agreed that school will start on August 17th. Some have advocated an earlier start than that to keep people back up if it's possible. Have they considered about how they're going to do this? Because if you have to maintain social distancing, you can only put half the number of kids or less in a classroom. We can't double our classroom space. We can't double our faculty. How are they going to do this?
I think that is a really open question that they're just starting to think about it now. You know, I think so much of what education was talking about was reactive, like how do we get kids computers? How do we get them online? And now it's like, oh no, we have to think about what's next. And they're just starting to ask themselves that question.
And one of the pieces of legislation deals with online learning, and a woman by the name of Angie Scioli, who is the founder of Red for Ed NC Teacher Group. I think they're responsible for the Monday marches in Raleigh of teachers, says that a quote, a piece of legislation that says we need to prove that online learning gets the same outcomes as in-person learning sets us up for failure. It's creating an impossible standard for us to try to meet. And that will be another way, she says, for the Republicans to claim that public schools are failing. What does this legislation do?
So the piece of the legislation is kind of that people have taken issue with is kind of what she said, right? Like districts have to show that their remote learning is equivalent to in-person learning. And I think just a common sense read of that knows that that will be almost impossible. Not all kids have access to the internet. Not all kids have access to like a quiet space to learn. And, you know, you're just in instruction for shorter amounts of time. You don't have the socio-emotional interactions that help you kind of cement things in your brain. And I believe what she's saying is if you're creating this bar that you're saying you failed if you can't meet it, but you already know that most districts can't meet it, it's just sort of like a ruse for them to be able to say, well, public school is failing. This is why we need to support charters. This is why we need to support private schools. And it goes back to the idea that you shouldn't you're criticizing public schools for failing while tying their hands behind their back. And I think
although the question is also open, are charters doing any better right now in this online learning situation?
And I think it depends a lot on the demographics of the charter. A lot of charter schools up in certain parts of the county it just kind of depends on the kind of students you're serving. A lot of charters that serve more low-income kids are facing the same issues as CMS. I think the difference is they have like more easy access to philanthropic money than certain school districts, not necessarily CMS do. So it really depends on each individual situation.
And closer to home this week, the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board approved a $1.6 billion budget that includes $36.7 million increase in county funding, taking the county's portion of this to $538 million. This in an environment where the county, the revenues are disappearing if they haven't already, and they're spending money hand over fist because of this COVID nonsense. The school board acknowledges that it is doubtful that they will get this money, this extra money from the county. So why ask for it? The county has said you're going to get flat funding. You're not going to get a raise. Why ask for it?
I think some of this is political, not in the partisan sense, but in the sense of like this CMS is making us, Ernest Winston characterized the budget as a statement of their priorities and a statement of their needs. And it is very, if that's what they think they need, that's what they're going to ask for. And they're going to put it on the county to say no to that. I think in CMS's defense, a significant part of that budget increase, more than half, is just coming from things that they are required to provide. And so if they took flat funding from the county, they'd effectively be taking like millions in cuts to other parts just to make those mandates possible.
So school board member, this got a little confusing for me because I don't follow the schools like you do, but school board member Sean Strain was the only no vote on this budget. And he said he voted no because it isn't representative of the district's needs. He says those needs are much greater than what the proposal asked for, but that the county should have scaled back because of the realities of COVID-19. You can't have it both ways, can you? I mean, is there a fallback plan for the county on this?
Don't know what the county's thinking. I think what Sean was trying to say is like, well, if we're going to do this as like a statement of our morals and ideas, then we should have like gone even bigger. We should have asked for a ratio of counselors that would be satisfactory for our kids. We should have asked for all this money that even in normal times we wouldn't expect to get. But since we're not in normal times, why are we treating it like normal times? We should be frugal. Okay. So I think he would have supported either end of the spectrum and hated that it fell in the middle.
So finally, for months, CMS has been working with a company called Centegix out of Georgia. I think they're out of Atlanta, on a security system that schools have said does not work. The company disagrees, but CMS has refused to pay the remaining $600,000 of its $1.75 million agreement and has now filed a lawsuit to get back the $1 million that they've already paid in. This was a system that was bought under the Clayton Wilcox administration under some specious, if that's the right word, conditions, because it's a $1.75 million deal with no contract. It was bought on a series of purchase orders. Is the confusion here over whether the system works or it doesn't work, over the fact that there is no contract to point out these are the expectations?
Yes. So CMS has crafted a legal argument around this. You know, under North Carolina law, a contract does not have to be a written document. And so CMS's argument is saying like, well, we laid out what we wanted in the bids. You didn't meet that. You signed the bid. Our bid had terms and agreements, and collectively as a whole, it was obvious what we were asking for and you failed to deliver. And I think, you know, I've been through some of CMS's testing records. It's obvious there were problems, like the beacon, like some of the lights were falling out of the ceiling. They couldn't turn the system off from Charlotte, so they had to call people in Atlanta. So there were like well-documented obvious failings that you wouldn't expect a system to have. So I think they have some legs to stand on. It'll just be less clear because the company could argue, you know, well, that's not what it means. We needed a written contract. It'll just kind of go to that question.
Okay.
And the company actually put out a statement afterwards saying, after the suit was filed, saying that they believe that this needs to be arbitrated according to Georgia law, which is where they're based. And so one of the first fights in this case will obviously be over whether there is a contract and how it should be dealt with.
Yeah, although that statement referred to the terms of the contract, but when I got that statement, they didn't give me what contract they were referring to, so I don't know.
Okay, so we have a minute left. Mayor Viall Lyles has said that her top priority is to set up local businesses to succeed once they're back online. The City of Charlotte partnered with Local Initiatives Support Corporation to deploy a micro business relief fund. How much money's in the pool? How do businesses get it? Eric.
It's $1 million, $10,000 cap, applications accepted as of Monday. And also, Mike, we should mention that the county has a separate $1 million micro business fund, and they have a $5 million small business fund. So you have several things going on with local government trying to fill some of those gaps from the federal and state programs.
And the legislature is also working on legislation to distribute $1 billion in funds, including $125 million in small business loans and $9 million for expanding broadband access in rural areas. Where does that stand? Do we know? Nobody knows. Okay. And we'll end on some good news for racing fans. NASCAR is opening. They're opening for business on May 17th at Darlington. They'll run 7 races in 10 days, including, if all goes as planned, the Coca-Cola 600 at the Charlotte Motor Speedway. But it'll be a very different race. Nobody in the stands, only on TV. Are they running the Indy 500 that same day? Do we know? We don't know. Of course not. We don't know. Steve Harrison, David Borax from WFAE, Annie Moll from the Charlotte Observer, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you all. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.